Hi, this is Alan Shartok. Delighted today because in the studio with us is David Grover. This summer marks the 30th anniversary of David Grover singing for children and families at the Bandstand in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. The town is marking this event this Labor Day weekend on Saturday at 10 a.m. in the Bandstand. David Grover has been compared to Mr. Rogers, James Taylor, Paul Simon, and Raffi, but his style is all his own. Grover has garnered over 30 awards, including Emmy and Grammy nominations, and top awards from Parents' Choice, NAPA, and other nonprofit groups spotlighting excellence in children's media. David Grover has performed at the White House, the Goodwill Games, the Today Show, the Detroit Symphony, and the United Nations. To hear this living legend is to instantly become a Grover groupie. This prolific singer-songwriter's Hanukkah at Grover's Corner, featuring Theodore Bickel, received a regional Emmy and has been played on PBS stations at holiday times for years and years. David says, singing for kids is where my heart is. Welcome, David Grover, an alumni not only of the Bandstand in Great Barrington and all the other great work, but of having a show right here on WAMC. Great to talk to you, David.
Good to be here. Great to talk to you.
David, how did it all start?
It started sort of the way the best things always do, which is totally by accident. And I think you were there for some of it. I started out, I was a single dad. I would go to school with my daughter, singing for parties and holiday things like that. I was not a kid singer then. I was a folk and roll singer.
Backed Pete on the road with Pete Shenandoah.
Yeah, I did that for many years. And if you told me back then I was going to end up a kid singer, I would have laughed at you. And then we had this little gig in Great Barrington at Dos Amigos.
I remember it's long gone now, but
it was a Mexican restaurant.
It was.
And quite by accident, there was a family I played for, and we used to call them, monkey in the corner gigs. You know, guitar players sit off in the corner, and you'd be mood music.
But it wasn't birthday parties, was it? Or
no, I was just being there for dinner, you know, and it was a boring gig. But one night in front of me was a big family, so I played for them, and I got the kids up to sing. And I said to the fellow who owned it, a guy named Peter Putnam, I said, why don't we do a family night?
Peter Putnam owned Dos Amigos?
Way back when.
I had no idea. Okay, great guy.
And so that's how it started. And, you know, if you're a family, if you're a mom and dad with kids, you know darn well there's not a restaurant in the world that wants to see you.
Meaning what? I'm sorry, David. What does that
mean? Well, you know, you see a bunch of kids come in with a family, and the waiter and waitress think, well, here comes a mess and a small tip. And to have a restaurant welcome you as a family and say, we want your kids.
Yeah, yeah.
Lines are around the block in about 3 months.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I expected it to be a small thing, and it turned out I just never got tired of playing for kids.
Yeah, but you also played a regular gig for years and years at the Red Lion Inn.
Yes, yes, I did. So I kept my hand in a little bit with adult music and still do.
Yeah. Well, I think people who are listening should know you're an amazing guitar player. There's very little that you can't do. It makes me jealous every time I see you play. But let's talk specifically about the anniversary of the gazebo, the bandstand in Great Barrington. Now, I want to set the scene for people and just tell everybody that you got to go to Great Barrington on Saturday mornings, what, at 10 o'clock?
10 o'clock.
10 o'clock. And you have to see every proud grandpa in the Berkshires is there and grandma with their little kids. And there's a fairly large natural amphitheater there, and they're all there. So it's really quite something. You see umbrellas, and you see kids who've brought their own guitars with them. It's really something. And to some degree, the town of Great Barrington has decided to support this. Not heavily, but they support it. Okay.
So they let us do it.
So, David, let's start at the beginning. How did you first get to that bandstand?
The first 3 years I bat at that bandstand was not even an official event. It was I would take my daughter on Saturday mornings. We'd go down there, and her and some friends and a couple other kids, maybe a dozen kids, 20 kids, we'd be under the bandstand. It wasn't a sanctioned event.
When you say under the bandstand, you mean in front?
underneath
the roof.
Underneath the roof there. Yeah. So it was a very small event. I mean, it was just me and a dozen kids. You know, we'd sing and play for an hour.
And did the words get out?
And then it got sort of bigger on its own. It kind of very naturally just sort of grew, and I started bringing Kathy and Terry and a little band. And
so Kathy is?
Kathy Jo, who is my wife.
Now,
who wasn't
but wasn't then. Right. Played the bass. And Terry Oliveri, who was with Shenandoah and you, right?
Yeah.
And helped to back Pete during all those years and still backs Arlo, and he's been on this. He's been in this studio before. And so you had a little band there.
So it was a real natural growth, and all of a sudden we looked up, and you know, 5, 6, 7 years had gone by, and it, all of a sudden there was 300-400 people there every Saturday morning.
How did you make money? I mean, how do you make money from that?
You don't.
Really? You just don't make
you
it?
You really don't. You can make a certain amount of money from selling merchandise.
Yeah, I bought a hat with a propeller on the
there
top.
There you go.
It.
That's that was
one of my proudest
possessions. That was the money we made. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can, you know, you make a little bit. But no, you do it because you love it, I think. To be honest with you, it's one of the ways to make contact with people. Of course, in the Berkshires, you got people from all over, you know, coming to see you.
Right.
So it's a way to make contact with people in terms of...
do you want to come down to Nourishell and play for my kids' anniversary?
Exactly right.
Birthday party.
Exactly right. So you hope for something like that.
Yeah.
You know?
And you've had a helper in all of this, sort of a helper manager, right?
Stephanie and Charlie Rothschild, they've been with us the whole time.
Yeah, and they're big fans.
Yes, it's been great.
But in the performance itself, it has taken on a sort of ritualistic thing. There are points at which you invite children to come up and sing part of, was it Tara Tara Bing Bang? I asked the witch doctor.
The witch doctor.
Yeah.
And there are certain tunes, they've changed a little over the years, but absolutely. I mean, for me, one of the reasons, you know, I love doing it for kids is it's not about you. And the kids, I mean, you mentioned my guitar playing, which I love to play guitar. It was,
well,
you know,
no,
my
you
first
are a
love.
Sensational guitar.
Kids could not care less how good a guitar player you are.
That's interesting.
Many times I've tried to impress them with my licks. They do not care. It is about the kids. And so for me, it's making the kids are the show for me. Bringing them up, making them part of it. And it is for them, too. They want to be part of the show. And you can always tell a good kids performer because it's not about him or her. It's about the audience and the kids they're playing for.
And it's participation. Meanwhile, right up the hill is the Saturday morning regular farmer's market on the other side of this railroad track.
That's right.
And you can hear what you guys are doing and what the kids are singing from up there. And it sort of feeds off each other. People come and go. So, David Grover, I see you brought your guitar. I am delighted with that. As I have said, I get jealous every time I see you play because you are just so good. And you've played with all of them, with Arlo, as we say, and with Pete. And here for these hundreds and now thousands of children, many of whom are grown up. I mean, think about that. 30 years ago, a 12-year-old is 42.
Well, my daughter, who I started playing for, you know, my grandkids are 14 and 16.
You have wonderful children, by the way. Wonderful daughter.
A little amazing it goes by.
So, David, what is the number one song that those children want to hear every time, no matter what? And repetition, as Pete has said, is the height of pedagogy.
My gosh.
I mean, if you sit there and you know that there's some things you're going to have to hear every week. So one of them, of course, is, as I mentioned before, I Saw the Witch Doctor.
Well, I always introduce this by saying, you know, of all the music you'll hear today, which is, you know, some wonderful music, it's probably this stupid song that's going to be stuck in your head late at night. I told the witch doctor I was in love with you. I told the witch doctor you didn't love me too. My friend the witch doctor, he told me what to do. Well, he said, ooh, ew, ah-ah, ting-tang, walla-walla-bing-bang. Ooh, ew, ah-ah, ting-tang, walla-walla-bing-bang. Yes, he said, ooh, ew, ah-ah, ting-tang, walla-walla-bing-bang. Ooh, ew, ah-ah, ting-tang, walla-walla-bing-bang. Now, at that point, the kids line up for their turn at their solo.
Oh, now, explain what that is all about.
They just come up and they do ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah.
So you have a little kid saying, ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah.
That's right. Ding, sometimes ding, in perfect pitch. And
sometimes not at all.
Just terrible, and it doesn't matter.
And of course, the grandparents and the rest are just so happy to see this happening.
And I am. I mean, you know, you wonder how you can play, for instance, that goofy song for that long.
It's 30 years.
Watching the kids. Yeah. That's my show. I get to look at these guys. I get to watch them grow up. I get to watch them go from being no singers at all to actually holding a tune. That's my thrill, you know.
Do you give guitar lessons?
I do.
So those kids will certainly think about that.
Yeah, eventually, yes, when they're old enough. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, David, so I asked you a question. You were cogitating on it. I want to ask it again. Of all the songs you play every week, which they demand every week, that's one. What else you got?
Well, there's a song I sing. It was, I actually learned out in California. It was written by some fourth and fifth grade kids. And we do it every week, and we get requests for it every week. And it's gotten to the point where there's a whole bunch of kids that know verses to it. So they come up and we'll actually sing the verses. It's called There's a Light in Me, There's a Light in You. There's a light in me, there's a light in you. Whatever language you speak, whatever your point of view, whatever people may say, whatever people may do. There's a light in you, you must let the light shine through. My friend Sam says she doesn't fit. When she wants to play, the kids wanna sit. Sometimes it's hard, I must admit. I hope she doesn't quit. She's gotta keep it lit. Oh, there's a light in me, there's a light in you. Whatever language you speak, whatever your point of view, whatever people may say, whatever people may do, there's a light in you, you must let the light shine through. One of the things that really struck me when I heard this song is the fourth and fifth graders who wrote this song instinctively knew, I don't know how, and this is something adults don't know, is that light that's inside of everyone. The times that you need it most are the times that it's hardest to find. And they wrote a verse about it. And this is their verse. When the world is looking grim, it can happen to her, it can happen to him. That's when you need that light to glow. Come on and let it show. It's brighter than you know. There's a light in me, there's a light in you. Whatever language you speak, whatever your point of view, whatever people may say, whatever people may do, there's a light in you. You must let the light shine through.
I love it. You were on the road, as I mentioned, with Pete Narlow for a long time and Shenandoah. Is life on the road hard?
Yes.
Why?
Traveling is hard. I mean, on the road, and I think it's maybe being a certain age, but just the very act of traveling and only getting, you know, you get 3 hours a day to make music.
Yeah.
And the rest, you got to kill.
You're on your
own.
It's
time to kill.
Yeah.
Now, when you're 20-odd years old, when I started playing with Arlo, you got things like...
Girls
and...
Liquor
and drinking and all kinds of stuff. But when, you know, when you have a kid and you're married and all that stuff is gone, you got a lot of time to kill. And just the act of traveling I probably don't have to tell you, is a tiring thing, moving from one place to another. First couple of years with Arlo, it was every morning, waking up at 5 in the morning, getting to the airport, taking a flight to the next place, you know, going to bed, waking up the next morning, going to the airport. That'll get you right there.
So how did you kill your time?
With women and liquor. You know, and in the end, of course, you know, after I had my daughter and turned out, you know, I was raising her myself, was when I left.
Why were you raising her by yourself, can I ask?
it was just one of those things where I was really good and really took to parenting, which was a surprise to me. Mm-hmm. But in terms of relationships, I didn't do so well.
Yeah, but she's a wonderful child. I mean, she is so pretty and so bright.
Very proud of her.
Yeah. Okay, being a backup person, does that have any downside to it as opposed to being a star yourself? I mean, in the, every Saturday morning, there you are, you're the star. And yet, you know, in Pete and Arlo and the rest of it, you're playing backup.
In some ways, on Saturday mornings, I'm backup too. I'm comfortable that way. I like to be backing people up. I enjoy backing up kids. I can tell you a story about what makes a good kids performer. I'm playing at the White House. I'm in charge of the children's stage. We have 30,000 kids on the White House lawn.
And was it Easter or something like
that? Yeah, it was an Easter egg roll. And every children's performer from all over the country is there, one of them being Tommy Chapin. So we have this big children's stage, and I'm in charge of kind of putting the children's stage together.
And so how'd they choose you? I mean, how did you get the gig?
Through Stephanie, you know, through our agent, Charlie. I mean, we did it 3 or 4 years in a row.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. By the way, who was the president then?
Mr. Clinton.
Mr. Clinton was the president.
Bill Clinton.
Did you get to talk to him during
the... No, not really.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
But we got to hear Janet Reno tell a great bunny story. So at the end, we had this big, you know, final thing with all the kids performers on stage doing one song. So we're thinking, what the heck do we do, you know, for all these kids? And so I thought for a minute. I turned to Tom Chapin and I said, why don't we do your brother's song? All my life's a circle, sunrise and sundown. Yeah, and it's simple chorus. And Tom said, sure, let's do it.
And by that time, was Chapin himself gone?
Harry was gone.
Yeah.
But Tom was there. And so Tom kicked us off with the chorus. And so what does he do for the first verse? He gives it to me. That's the difference between a kid's performer and an adult performer. You give it away. He didn't need to take the whole song. He just immediately started sharing the verses. And that's what playing for kids is about. It's not about you being the star, because the kids don't think of you as a star. They don't know who you are. They don't care that I play Arlo or Pete or that I'm good at guitar. They want to be part of what's going on. And when Tom did that, I said, that's a kids performer.
How much of Harry's song do you remember now?
Oh, I still know that song.
Can you play it for us?
Sure. All my life's a circle, sunrise and sundown. The moon rolls through the nighttime till the daybreak rolls around. All my life's a circle, and I can't tell you why. The season's spinning round again, the years keep rolling by. Well, it seems like I've been here before, but I can't remember when. But I've got this funny feeling, oh, that I'll be back once again. There's no straight lines make up my life, and all my roads have bends. There's no clear-cut beginnings, and so far no dead ends. Oh, all my life's a circle, sunrise and sundown. The moon rolls through the nighttime till the daybreak rolls around. All my life's a circle, and I can't tell you why. The season's spinning round again, the years keep rolling by. Oh, those years keep rolling by.
Love that song. Love that song.
It's
and of course,
great song.
You guys all played it together on the road. I remember that so well.
Yes.
Yeah. How about friends? Do you have friends? Do you have any friends?
What an interesting question. I'm not sure how to answer that.
I wouldn't know how to answer it either. I think I have friends, but I'm not absolutely sure.
I think I have friends.
But do you have anybody that you're particularly close with musically?
Well, of course, you know, for 25 years, I had a writing partner, you know, who passed away a couple of years ago, who I still miss terribly. His name is Aaron Schroeder. And we wrote 5 days a week.
Really? And he was a very famous Tin Pan Alley sort of...
He was, Brill Building guy.
Yeah. And yes. He wrote a lot of the songs for Elvis.
He wrote 19 songs for Elvis, yeah.
Yeah. He saw something in you that he really liked, and he became a mentor. Is that right?
He did. I mean, he taught me about songwriting. He taught me what the rules of songwriting are and
what
how
are
to
they?
Break them.
What are some
well,
of them?
Well, he always said there's a million rules to songwriting, and there isn't any at all. Uh-huh. And, of course, his hero was Irving, Mr. Berlin.
Yeah.
That's where he came from. So he came from the world of... He was a lyricist,
the
basically.
American songbook sort of thing.
You betcha, Roger Hammerstein, sure. You know, people like that.
Yeah. So you sit down with them and you write songs together.
We would write forever and ever, yes.
That's, do you have one you can play us that, you know, a sort of tribute to our friend Aaron Schroeder, who I like so much?
Reaching a little back for this one. Let's
okay,
give it a try.
That's all right.
It doesn't take much to make you happy. It doesn't take much to make you smile. Just be a friend you can trust and depend on. You'll see the someone you'll be is someone worthwhile. It doesn't take sense to know that dollars will never buy love or a heart that's true. You've got it made as long as you're making someone in your little world as happy as you. Most people go round and round on a merry-go-round for who knows what. Oh, silly girl, silly boy, you gotta enjoy the things you've got. It doesn't take much to make you happy. It doesn't take much to make you smile. Just be a friend you can trust and depend on. You'll see the someone you'll be. Look in the mirror, what do you see? You'll see the someone you'll be is someone worthwhile.
I love that.
And, yeah, I haven't done that for... forever.
See, I'm glad you dropped by.
I mean, Aaron was a fellow who did not believe in imperfect rhymes. I
mean,
that was a rule. In other words, you didn't rhyme smile miles.
Right.
I mean, this is a rule. Yeah. You can look through the entire Rodgers and Hammerstein songbook. You will not find an imperfect rhyme.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Or Berlin. That's one of those rules. Now, these days... there's a purposely imperfect rhymes in order to mess songs up. But that's one of those rules that you can break them, but know them first.
Yeah, well, that's what they always say before, you know, you can throw a bunch of paint at a canvas. You better know how to paint.
That's right. That's right.
So now, as I mentioned earlier, you played around at a lot of the joints in the Berkshires.
Lord knows.
Yes, the Red Lion, for example, where we came to hear you many times. And there was it always ticked me off that, you know, you always had some drunks and people who were sitting around and making a lot of noise. And these are not concert venues. You're giving a concert, you're up there, but they're screaming and they're yelling and they're giggling. And, you know, how do you deal with that? I've often wondered.
Well, you know, it took a long time to get used to it. I mean, I can work a place like the Lion's Den. I'm pretty much used to the room. It's not an easy room to work.
Big, long room.
Big, long room. And I can bring my own crowd into there.
Oh, that's right. They depend on you. I mean, we used to meet people there who'd say, I'd go anywhere to hear David. And so you had groupies.
Yes. So I was fortunate for that. Now, there's a lot of those venues I just can't play. I don't want to play anymore.
Yeah.
You know, we were half joking earlier about women and alcohol and drugs. Yeah. Well, I haven't had a drink of alcohol in 27 years. And I can't play for a room full of drunks anymore.
Interesting.
I just can't.
What
do
is it? What is it that you find so? Is it the temptation that's there, or is it the fact that you see yourself in the old days?
No, it's just playing for people who just don't care a lot. I don't need everyone's total attention, and I don't mind doing sort of my share of the work to get their attention.
Sure.
But, you know, just to play for people who are there to just get loaded is not my idea of a good time. Other people can do it. I mean, God bless them. Let them have the gig. But, you know, at my age, I've done it enough. You know, 30 years at the bandstand, but I've been doing this, I think, as of next year. I've been a professional musician for 50 years.
Wow. And did you grow up in Pittsfield?
I did.
And how did you come to music?
Boy, my first instrument was the clarinet. I was in love with Benny Goodman.
Interesting.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
And then I fell in love with Elvis, so I got to be a guitar player. This is pre-Beatles now.
Yeah.
So I lived and breathed the guitar.
You were in high school, though?
Not yet.
Oh, not yet?
No, I started playing. My first professional gig was at what was then called the Berkshire Playhouse in Stockbridge. I was 13 years old. It was 1965.
And what was the gig?
It was the Threepenny Opera. I was in the pit.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. It was myself. It was Mr. Terry Oliveri was playing drums. And the keyboard player was a fellow named Bob Blayfield, who's well known in
sure.
the Berkshires.
How did they find you? How did you find them? How'd you get the gig?
You know, I can't barely remember other than they found us because of our age. They knew we were going to be pretty darn cheap.
And what grade were you in at the time?
How old are you when you're 13? Yeah, okay. Seventh grade?
Junior high school like or something
that.
Like
yeah,
that.
Just barely junior high school.
Wow.
But I was, you know, right from the start, I practiced guitar 4 to 6 hours every day. And you can get pretty good pretty quick.
You have to have it. I mean, you know, I played the trumpet. I played all the time until my parents told me to shut up. And I played the guitar and the banjo, but I couldn't get to be that good. So I've always thought there's a gene out there that somebody's either born with or you're not.
There's a drive, for sure. I don't think it's a gene.
I had the drive. I didn't have the... I was okay, but I never was great like you are. So that's the thing. I think it's genetic. I watched Lang Lang play the piano this summer. We were right in front of him on the stage and Yo-Yo the same morning. And watch these guys. They have to be born with that. They just have to be.
There is something. I know that when I have a guitar student come in, I'll know when a kid is going to be that, period. It's not even a choice for him. Like, it wasn't a choice for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've got it. And I mean, my sort of stock answer to somebody a student that asked me, should I go into music? Because I immediately say no. And they get all kind of huffy and go, well, you know, how can you say no so quickly? I said, because you asked.
Yeah, yeah.
People that go into music don't ask. They know what they're going to do.
Interesting.
You may be right about the gene, but it's something in there that you find, that you connect with. And I think in my case, in many cases, there are people that is their way to communicate. Before I was a musician, for instance, I grew up with a pretty bad stutter. I wasn't...
Really?
Yeah. I was very bad at communicating. And music was the way I saw to communicate. And this is true of other musicians I know. You may have had enough other ways to communicate, just you yourself, and apart from your music.
You mean me, Alan?
Yes, yes, okay. In terms of your playing.
Yeah.
That it wasn't your only way out.
That's fascinating.
And to tell you the truth, I don't have a real answer that I know for sure, but I just know them when I see them.
Yeah, yeah.
When they come in and I go, he's not asking anybody about whether he should play guitar or not.
You mentioned that you were a clarinet player as a kid, and I think of Woody Allen. Now, there's a very talented guy, just to argue your point, your thesis with you, who has a lot of ways to communicate. And
You're right.
He keeps going back to that clarinet and that band of his.
Yeah, and I still, to this day, will listen to the sound of that clarinet and just fall in love all over again.
Yeah. Do you ever pick it up?
I haven't for a long time. I picked it up once. You know, after 5 minutes, my mouth's ready to fall off.
Oh, that's interesting.
You got to play it. You know, you got to. If you don't use it, you just lose it.
You do. You know, there's always that moment when you decide, here I am in my 70s now, that maybe I should pick up my trumpet, start to play it again. And then I do, and God, is it awful.
Oh, yeah, and your mouth hurts for 2 days, you know?
Yeah.
And you realize how hard it is. I mean, every student I've ever had, you always hit this point where they all of a sudden they realize, wait a minute, this is going to be really work if I want to be good.
When you were on the road with Pete Narlo and all the gang, what was your favorite thing that you all did together? Favorite song?
I don't know if there was a favorite song. There was always these favorite moments, and Pete was famous for them. Pete was one of my heroes, since I was little enough to remember,
We, of course, for the few.
My favorite moments are those moments that Pete would just pull out of his hat and do the thing you would just least expect him to do. That might have been the most inappropriate thing to do at any given gig, and we'd all do it with him.
And it was all just, you just do it.
We just do it.
Well, can you think of one?
Just in the middle of sort of a very, one of these Tanglewood-type venues, like a Ravinia Festival or something like that. After Arlo had just done some political statement on Victor Jara or something like that, and Pete would get up and sing, great green gobs of greasy, grimy gopher guts, mutilated monkey. He'd do something like that or something, and he would always find some off-color song that would be just enough to shock people. He loved to do that once in a while, and I would wait for those moments, and Arlo had that in him, too. Those were my favorite moments, the ones that you didn't know were coming.
Mm-hmm. Did you learn anything when you were touring with these guys? Did you learn anything about music?
Well, I certainly learned everything about performing. I used to watch, even when Arlo would get up and do the solos, I would stay right out there and just watch him. And there was nobody better at holding a stage than Pete. The most people I've ever played in front of was in Milwaukee. It was Arlo and Pete in the band, and it was 120,000 people.
Whoa.
Pete had no trouble holding that group.
Oh, no.
His ability to hold the stage was just matchless. Whatever that power that he had in him, when he'd lift his arms up, to get people to sing.
And just move his wrist, and 100,000 people would sing at once.
And to just watch them, my first group of kids' songs I learned just from listening to Pete.
For example, Abby Yo-Yo.
Abby Yo-Yo. I started to sing it just because I'd heard him do it so many times.
And you've done it at the bandstand with the kids?
Oh, sure.
Can you play us a little?
Well, we can't do the story.
No. But just give us the chorus.
Well, the chorus, of course,
it's
is just
quite easy. Just his name.
Abby Yo-Yo, Abby Yo-Yo. Abby yo yo, abby yo yo, abby yo yo, yeah yo yo, yeah yo yo, abby yo yo, yeah yo yo, yeah yo yo. And of course, he goes on to tell the story of Abby yo yo, this very mean giant. Now, I have the original record of Abby yo yo, where he tells the story, and then he just keeps playing this little lick. Do-do-do-do, for another 20 minutes.
Yeah.
As the kid falls asleep.
Oh, yeah.
And so the whole side is just, this 10-minute story or 7-minute story, and then 20-odd minutes of just him and a banjo. Do-do-do-do.
There are some of those stories out there, David, some of those records out there that we'll never find again. When I was at Camp Bronx House as a counselor, somebody had left behind one summer a Pete Seeger record of Pete playing Pop Goes the Weasel on the banjo. Well, let me tell you, there was no singing. It was just this fabulous banjo rendition of this. And, you know, people say, well, you know, Earl Scruggs, this one and that one. But Pete's a hell of a banjo
player. He's a hell of a banjo player. Yeah. He sure is.
So when I think of Abby Yo-Yo, I think of Pete's gift. You know, he always would quote his father as saying, borrowing music is endemic to all mankind. And he would talk about how people basically rob from each other. And one summer, a group of us from the camp went out to Fire Island, where I was raised, to sing for the kids out there. And I sang, of course, I never knew Abby Yo-Yo, never knew the words. So what I did is I knew the song, so I made up my own version of Abby Yo-Yo. Well, you know, about how Abby Yo-Yo threw toilet paper into the Great South Bay. And the whole idea was to get it all out of there. And the way they fooled him was to put ketchup on top of the toilet paper. And Abby Yo-Yo came and guffed it all up. And there was a counselor there, and the counselor was in a boat, and Pete came out to play, and he took Pete out in his boat, Bobo Peck, I believe it was, and he told him my version. Well, Pete was then writing a monthly column for a Sing Out magazine.
Johnny Appleseed.
Johnny Appleseed. And I know what writing columns can be like. You need a column.
Yeah.
So he wrote this column about the folk process and how this guy, never named me,
right,
to say this counselor sang him the song in a boat with the version and told him the version and how Abby Yo-Yo swallowed all the toilet paper in the Great South Bay with ketchup on top of it. So years later, I really get to know Pete fairly well, and I go up there and I do those now sort of famous interviews with him and biographical interviews with him. And I come in and I say, you know, Pete, years ago, you were in a sailboat with a kid. He said, are you the guy? I could not believe it. David was there, our producer. Are you the guy? He knew that, and he was proud of it.
He thought
that was wonderful.
Yeah.
Or who could forget him teaching us all the limbo at the Music Inn when we were 14? So, yeah, you know, it all comes back. But back to you. Is there a moment you remember with him between you?
Well, he would take me off to the side and teach me some kids' songs once I started doing kids'
really?
Music. Yeah, and that would be great fun. And one of the things I remember most about Pete is he would get lost. We would lose him in an airport, for instance, and we'd have to go find him. One time, we were afraid the plane was going to leave without us, and I found him. He was sitting on the scale that weighed the luggage, and he was bouncing up and down, watching the little scale going up and down. And the other thing I noticed is that Pete was the furthest thing from a flower child that there was.
No, he was formal.
Pete was not about all peace and love, and Pete was somebody who fought for what he believed.
That's right, and he had real dignity.
He did, and if you... He
still has it, by the way. I don't want to use the past
tense. You could get him... I've seen him get angry at people who have been mistreated or in front of him. And he doesn't fool around. And I think I learned a lot from that, his seriousness that it isn't all just peace and love. You got to stand up. You got to stand up and take that march and take that hit.
And I've been a thousand stories about, you know, people who were mistreated in a line waiting to see him, how he grabbed them and said, come on in. You know, those are the stories you're talking about.
And the stories of him and Otto Preminger, I don't know.
Remind me of that one again. I forget it.
Well, he was briefly in the movie Anatomy of a Murder.
He was?
Yeah, he opens up the movie. In fact, he's still in there.
Really?
And he was on the set, and someone had screwed up a scene, like a light.
Go ahead.
And Otto Preminger took him apart. You know, he was famous for his temper.
He took the worker apart.
He took the worker apart.
Yeah.
And of course, at any set, there's, you know, 40 people around, you know, workers. And he turned around, and there was Pete. And Pete grabbed Otto Preminger by the front of the shirt.
I have heard it.
And lifted him up and said, and literally threw him onto the ground and said, don't ever talk to your workers like that again. Well, that was the end of Pete's film career.
The next film was in Alice's Restaurant 100 years later.
Yeah, that's right. You're probably right. Yeah. That probably was the next one. But he could not stand to see that sort of injustice of, you know, just this poor light guy. I mean, Otto Preminger just ripped him apart and was known for it. I mean, you know, was known for that temper, isn't it? But Pete wasn't worried about it. And that was it for Pete. He was gone.
Pete never worried about that stuff. I mean, you know, the rougher it was. I mean, after all, look at all the guys who gave him a rough time, who he has forgiven, Burl Ives and Josh White and some of the people who named him. But he stood up at those points of the game, and there's a lot of people who think that Toshi was right. He was annoyed that they didn't keep him in jail longer than the couple of hours that they had him in after they arrested him.
And he also had the most openly musical mind. In other words, there's a group of people that I sort of like to call the folk police. And they're not huge fans of mine. If you use more than five or six chords, they're really not on your side.
I hear you.
Pete is exactly the opposite of that. You would think if there was going to be a folk police type person, I mean, Pete's folk music to me, you know.
Sure.
But Pete is wide open, loves, you know, fooling around with different times. I got a call from him once, and he wanted any version I had of this song that's in 5/4 time that Harry Belafonte had written, actually. And I had several versions of it. And so,
what was the song you meant?
Let's see if I can do it. We come from the mountain, living on the mountain. Go back to the mountain, turn the world around. Now that's a song, so instead of your average four, you're counting fives. This fascinated him. When Pete wrote his song about Martin Luther King, I think he used 7/4.
Interesting.
Down in Alabama, 1955, not many of us here today were then alive. A young Baptist preacher led a bus boycott. He showed a way for a brand new day without firing a shot.
Don't say it can't be done. The battle's just begun. Take it from Dr. King and you can learn to sing from Dr. Gunn.
You can sing it with us. Don't say it can't be done. Sing that.
Don't say it can't be done.
Good. The battle's just begun. Sing that.
The battle's just begun.
Take it from Dr. King. Got it?
Take it from Dr. King.
You too can learn to sing. Got it?
You too can learn to sing.
So drop the gun.
So drop the gun.
Here we go.
Not an easy song.
Not an easy song, and this stuff was fascinated
him.
He didn't care about you knew more than four chords.
But he was, of course, raised by two brilliant musicians.
But there are many, many folk singers that shy away from being, for lack of a better word, fancy or better.
Sure. Do you ever think, David, about your own career? Now, you're as good as anybody I've ever met. The guitar work is fabulous. You've got a fine voice, really good. And yet, there are some people who go to the mountain, and there are some people who don't. And I've often thought, we have a woman in the Berkshires, I'm sure you know her, Vicky True, who always felt could have played any Broadway part, but didn't. So somehow the fickle finger doesn't rest on you.
I don't have an answer to it. I don't know myself, especially, you know, having kind of chose this path of sort of children's music. And then, of course, when the recession hit, kids go first. So,
sure.
You know, business is rough.
Sure, but they still show up on Saturday mornings.
Yes, they do. But just in terms of the amount of gigs out there and working and making a living and things like that, it's a tough time. And why, as you said, whatever happens, it's, I don't have an answer for you.
You did an amazing PBS special that we alluded to before, which is the Hanukkah program. Some very famous folk singer who I think you can probably know, who's concerned about, you know, things like being paid, said to me once, I did something for them, and I see it every year going round and round, and I never see any money as a result of, you know, this thing. Do you, I mean, this Hanukkah thing that you did, you're not Jewish, right?
I'm not, no. Yeah. I had to learn all about it.
And yet you came up with this very special thing about Hanukkah. Tell us that story. How did that happen?
I think, you know, me and Aaron had written a Hanukkah song. And, of course, Aaron was Jewish. So we had that to draw from, and we started getting some gigs around Hanukkah time. And I was just at a loss to find any decent songs about Hanukkah.
Yeah, there were two. Dreidel, dreidel, dreidel.
Dreidel, which, yeah. And so and I started learning about Hanukkah. You know, learned more than probably anybody needs or wants to know about it. And just started writing these songs, which turned into an idea for this television show with the people we were working with at Public TV in Springfield. I never saw any money from that either.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, PBS TV is, you know, famous for, yeah, I don't know at what point any kind of royalties kick in, but it it was played for a long time. I don't think they play it anymore. But I became just fascinated with the learning about these different holidays. And I mean, I have a CD right now that's just about done of several kind of Jewish celebrations, holidays.
So like what?
Well, every year we go and we play at the Jewish Museum in Manhattan.
Uh-huh.
And it's for different holidays sometimes. Sometimes it's Passover, sometimes it's Sukkot, sometimes it's Purim. And I like to write a song for them every year. But we've been doing this for 12 years now, so I have a lot of songs about different celebrations.
Can you play us one Jewish song?
Boy, is that a good question. Sure. The true story of how matzah came to be.
And here I always thought I knew.
When Moses led the people out of Egypt, they ran for their lives from the Pharaoh so cruel. They ran all night, they ran till they were sick. They were tired and hungry and they needed something quick. Mama said, I know what will do the trick. Matzah, matzah, yummy, yummy matzah. Matzah, matzah, bacon in the pan. A piece for you, a piece for me, a piece for the children walking through the sea, a piece for everybody in the world to be free. Save a piece for the Afikoman. Save a piece for the Afikoman. There's no time to bake it like a challah. We just can't wait for the yeast to rise. Bake it in a circle, bake it in a square. It's flour and water and good clean air. Bake it with your mom, bake it with a prayer. Matzah, matzah, yummy, yummy matzah. Matzah, matzah, bacon in the pan. A piece for you, a piece for me, a piece for the children walking through the sea, a piece for everybody in the world to be free. Save a piece for the Afikoman. Save a piece for the Afikoman. There's a little bit of that.
I love it. You come by this naturally. As a child, I know that you played with Jewish kids in Pittsfield.
Sure.
And
but I didn't. I never knew about it. There was always this sort of...
I mean, you mentioned the Afikoman, which, of course, is that one matzah which the kids chase during the Seder.
The end of the Seder, yes.
Yeah, right. And they get rewarded for it. So you know a lot.
Well, and some of this is having to learn. Like, for instance, if we're doing a Passover show, I get out my Judaism for Idiots book. Uh-huh, you know, which exists and is true, you know. But I have a lot of, you know, material that I can look up. I mean, doing songs about, and I don't think I can do it off the top of my head, but I found that the celebration of Purim was fascinating.
Yeah.
Because it's turned into such a...
Well, it's a great story.
It's a great story, and there's something very special about that story. It is the one celebration where God does not do the miracle.
Oh, interesting.
Is that God gave it to the people, or in this case, Esther, to do the miracle. Now, every other one, Sukkot, he has manna from heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he has all this other stuff.
Well, I always like Jonah going to Nineveh, sitting under the tree, the worm dropping the... there, and a great tree comes over him. The worm eats the tree. It's all God's work.
There you go. God stays out of it. He says, this is for you to do. And that's what I, you know, it's easy to kind of focus kid-like on sort of the groggers, it's almost Halloween aspect of it.
Sure.
You know, so the song I wrote was more about the courage to make a miracle happen, you know.
Are you absolutely sure God had nothing to do with it?
Well, no, he did in the terms of...
The overview.
He pointed it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And the idea is...
Haman did hang from the tree. Right.
What's that? Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Indeed.
And Queen Esther was Queen Esther and all the rest. So what do you do now, David? We only have 2 more minutes, but what do you do? People want you to come to sing at a party, or they want to...
I mean, you know, I'm going to do the next gig is really the answer.
I'm just going to do the next gig.
You know, I'm going to do the next thing, whatever it is. I mean, like I said, after when the economy sort of went south, a lot of the bigger and better gigs took big hits.
But if they want you, they go to davidgrover.com?
.com will get you anywhere. You have to click around a little bit. You can get to Stephanie. You can get to the Facebook page. You can get here and there.
Yeah.
But davidgrover.com will get you there.
So, David, this is going to be the grand celebration. 30 years at the Great Barrington Bandstand. Kids have grown up with you. They've played the air guitar. They've sang Witch Doctor song. And
we'll have a special guest. Terry Oliveri is going to come by for a couple songs.
Great.
So
you're a great drum playing pal. So what song are you going to play us out with?
Let's play us out with a Pete song, which I don't know how much of a kid song it is, but the kids like it. The skiers turn, the swimmers learn, the lovers burn. Peace may the generals learn when I'm far away. Well, may the world go, the world go, the world go. Well, may the world go when I'm far away. Oh, sweet may the fiddle sound, the banjo plays the old hoedown. Dancers swing round and round when I'm far away. Well, may the world go, the world go, the world go. Well, may the world go when I'm far away. Sweet may the breezes blow, clear may the streams flow, the blue above, the green below, when I'm far away. Well, may the world go, the world go, the world go. Well, may the world go when I'm far away. Well, may the world go, the world go, the world go. Well, may the world go when I'm far away.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.